G'day everyone, and welcome back to the Peter Maxwell Slattery Show. And back on the show today, we've got Rick Osmond. How you going, Rick?
I'm well, thank you. And you?
Good, mate. Good. It's a pleasure to have you back on, and thank you for taking the time out to come back on. We had an awesome last show. You're in the U.S. military. You've done a lot of work on ancient America. You've wrote the book, The Graves of the Golden Bear, which the links are up to on, which will be up on this video as well as the last video we did. So for a bit more background on Rick, probably go to the last show. Now, I wanted to get you back on so the viewers to talk about the Hollow Earth. So where would you like
to...
One of your favorite topics?
Let's see. How did I get interested in the Hollow Earth? Well, of course, I started, like most people who are interested, I probably started the same way with Jules Verne, Journey to the Center of the Earth, which doesn't really take the reader to the center of the earth. It takes the reader into subterranean realms of the earth. If it had been truly the center, everyone would have been truly weightless, because at the very center of the earth, there's zero gravitation. It's actually pulling outward instead of inward. So that's one of the premises that I've arrived at after right at 20 years of, research and reading and study, that at the exact center of this planet and all such planets and all such bodies in the universe, the gravitation has to be zero. There is, in fact, a chance that it fluctuates around zero. So you could actually have very slightly negative gravity. A repulsive force, if you would. And that also falls in line with some of the quantum physics and more exotic physics of the mid to late 20th century and onward. But the Hollow Earth, or the subterranean realms in more particular, go back to our oldest writing on the planet, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh sent his friend Enki to the underworld to look up Gilgamesh's mother, who was a god or some kind of immortal, and he wanted to get that immortality for himself, but he couldn't go below without losing his life in the meantime. So Gilgamesh sent his friend Enki, who reported back somehow and was able to communicate, but could not return to the surface, according to all the translations of the original clay tablets, which are now, 5,000 years old.
Are these the Sumerian very first tablets?
Yes.
Yep.
The Epic of Gilgamesh. So, you know, the oldest writing we have talks about realms within the earth coming forward in time, in, you know, reality. Let's skip forward to, let's say, Sir Edmund Halley. Does it sound familiar? Halley's Comet, the guy who discovered the periodic nature of comets and predicted that 76-year plus or minus cycle that we now know is true for Halley's Comet. He is also the guy who sponsored Sir Isaac Newton in all of his gravitational studies, etc. And Newton was just putting it on a shelf, and Halley said, dude, you've got to publish this. Here's the money. And he sponsored it, quite literally sponsored, and became a patron of Isaac Newton. Otherwise, we would never have heard of Isaac Newton. Halley had done a study on board ship across the North and Mid-Atlantic studying the magnetic poles of the Earth. He wanted to find out just how good a compass really was and what it was really pointing at, because they already knew by then that it wasn't pointing directly at the axis pole of the Earth, at the geographic pole. It was pointing at a magnetic pole, which was in a separate place. And in fact, we now know that it moves. It's not always in the same place. The declination of a compass changes pretty much on an annual basis. If you have a compass in Iceland, it points west, not north, as an example. Yep. So he was studying the magnetic nature of the Earth, and he came up with this hypothesis slash theory that the Earth was actually several concentric spheres, seven of them in his count. He started out with four, and he grew it up to seven. And he said that they probably could be inhabited, some of them. We don't I don't think that, but a lot of people still hang on to that, that there are inner realms of highly sophisticated, highly technological Nazi survivors, etc. There are 1,000 different versions of who lives inside the Earth. There are, of course, the versions where there are holes at the poles, North and South Pole, etc. Coming forward from Sir Edmund Halley, we have John Clive Sims, who went to U.S. Congress trying to get money to go explore, look for the hole at the pole. He never was successful in getting that sponsorship. You had a lot of other folks who wanted to explore the inner Earth. No one has ever been successful, to my knowledge, although there are a couple of really good stories that are almost certainly complete fiction that are pretty good as far as the physics. The physics works in both of these books. One is called The Smoky God, and it was published, I believe it was in 1896, and it's about a Norwegian lad who was shipwrecked in 1829 at the North Pole, entered the Earth, went through the inner Earth, hollow, and came out in Antarctica and was rescued. His name was Olaf Janssen. Of course, Johnson is the most common name in all of European surnames, but and Olaf being pretty common in Scandinavia. At any rate, he was he did have a contemporary by that name in Batavia, New York. I'm sorry, but yeah, Batavia, New York, and then later on Batavia, Illinois. And he is buried up there near Batavia, Illinois. Another book that talked about roaming the inter-earth is called Edda, which is Aphrodite spelled backwards. And it was supposedly narrated by this old geezer who said, "I am the man," meaning the man who roamed the inner earth. But he has all the physics right. And he has a lot of other geology and chemistry and biology right, we think, for what should be in the earth. So it's kind of interesting that way. Coming forward a little further, in the 1970s and early 1980s, what is now the Russian Federation, the Soviet Union, drilled a hole into the Earth about 14 kilometers before their rig completely failed on the drilling. They ran into things they did not expect, or they would have drilled to 20 kilometers, 20,000 meters. They ran into temperatures and densities and materials that should not have been there if conventional theory was even close to being right. There was hydrogen gas bubbling up from 12,000 meters. There shouldn't be any gases there. It was hydrogenated mud. It would actually explode and burn. They hit temperatures 100 degrees Celsius higher than they expected at depth. And it melted their bits, which is why they had to quit. They hit densities of material that they should not have been hitting until they got down another 20 miles or another, what would that be, 31 kilometers. Something's wrong with our conventional theory. So they have all this data about this hole that they drilled. They said, "That's odd. We're going to stick with the theory we have." Excuse me? That's not good scientific method.
Exactly, yeah.
The Kola borehole, I have trouble saying that phrase, in Russia was, in Siberia, is the deepest drilled hole still on the Earth that we, you know, have in any of our books. And yet it hasn't changed our views for some odd reason. So we have all these theories that say, okay, there's this iron ball. There's an outer molten ball of iron, and there's an inner solid core of iron, and it causes all these magnetic fields of the Earth. It's like, really? Because remember that part where there's zero gravity at the center? Why would all that dense stuff be at the center? It would not be. It would be at some radius less than the surface and higher than the center. So the theory is on a a bad basis to begin with about having an iron core like that. Yes, there is a magnetic field. But, you know, and they say, well, it's because we got all this iron. Well, you know, Mars has a lot of iron also, but they have it has no magnetic field at all. And no atmosphere and none of those other things. So anyone who volunteers to go to Mars, be sure and wear your tinfoil hat because nothing else is going to save you. The radiation will kill you on Mars. It's even killing the rovers slowly. Back to the inner Earth thing. If there is this dynamo slash iron core effect going on, then there should be a lot of other electromagnetic effects that are absent. So you can't have it one way without having both ways. But they don't change the theory at all. And I really don't understand where they're coming from on that supposed scientific method.
Well, it just doesn't stand up, does it? No, like you're making sense, and it doesn't make sense how they've gone about that in terms of you look at the scientific understanding. And for the listeners and viewers, we've just got to look, like on the show we talk a lot about people's encounters with otherworldly beings. I do it myself. But when we talk about just Earth here, we've got to realize that we almost know more about outside of our Earth in terms of space and everything else than what's going on right here at home. And I think we actually need, and it might sound weird coming from me, but focus here before we focus out there. I think it's good to know what we know in terms of astronomy and star systems and nebulas and everything in space. But even now,
we know far more about the chemistry and the physics of the surface of the sun than we do at anything below a mile in the ocean.
Exactly. And this is where now scientifically we are starting to learn so much more about, just in the oceans, for example, what's kilometers underneath. We're finding new species of different types of fish and whatever down there. So when we talk about this, what you were saying does make sense. And if people take the time out to think, well, hey, we actually don't know much about Earth compared to what we know about the sun and the moon and so forth, it starts to go, well, this is possible. And when you look at the scientific understanding of what you're saying, there is a scientific basis for it. So it's not something you've just pulled out of, you know, the atmosphere. You've got some basis for what you're saying along with a lot of other people.
Oh, yeah, I've done a lot of research on this, and I'm certainly not the only one. What I try to do, though, is I try to pick the best ideas of various people. One of those people you may be acquainted or at least aware of, his name is Neil Adams. And if you were ever a fan of the Batman comic books, you know who Neil Adams was, or the Green Arrow, or some of the other DC characters, because he was the artist, and he is still the artist 50-odd years later. I've had the privilege of shaking his hand and talking to him for hours, but not so much about the comic books. Yes, we did talk a little bit about comic books because, well, I mean, he's the guy. But we also talked about what he calls his science project. And it is the phrase growing Earth. Now, in Australia, there's another guy by the name of, I forget his first name, his last name is Maxlow, and he is a geologist/geophysicist. And his theory is called the expanding Earth theory. Neil took it one step further, that the Earth is actually growing. There's new material forming inside the Earth all the time. Both of those theories are based on a single phenomenon, that there is new material forming at the surface all the time. But this whole thing of subsidence where the continents dive under one another, there's no real evidence of that. It's a supposition on the basis, well, the ocean rifts are coming apart, therefore they have to be going someplace where the Earth would be growing, and it can't be growing because the Earth is static. Sorry, the Earth is not static. Neil has, being the artist that he is, you know, world-renowned, and not just for comic books, but he's also an animator. And he has made a number of videos showing how the crust of the Earth has expanded over a ball, the globe, if you will, without the crust actually getting bigger. So if you shrink the radius of the Earth back to about half of what it is today, all the continents come and fit together perfectly. Absolutely perfectly. And they start spreading apart only if the radius of the Earth increases. So, if we assume that Neil is correct about this, then we have to come up with some explanation of how can a body in space actually grow without accreting material from outside. Well, it has to be forming new on the inside. Okay, let's go look at physics and see how that could happen. We get this equation, a little-known equation by a little-known guy by the name of Albert Einstein. It says E equals MC squared. Well, the E, you can turn that around, and mass equals energy. And there's no way to actually put that many zeros onto the video like this, but it takes a lot of energy to create matter. But it is possible. A guy by the name of, it'll come to me in a minute. One of the greatest physicists of our time, maybe a little bit before your time, came up with a formula of how energy crossing a zero axis can form new matter. Kind of like the energy from vacuum, except it's now matter. And it makes what is essentially a nano white hole. It's like one quark of matter forms from a wave crossing a point in space. Well, one quark doesn't make the Earth grow. But when you start putting, you know, one quark to the 82nd exponent, now you've got a softball that grew. And if you do that for 4 billion years, now you have half a planet. Mm-hmm. And that's what I believe. And if I were better at the math, I could probably show it mathematically, but I'm not that good at it anymore. That is what has caused our Earth to double in radius, according to most of the data, in about the last 70 to 75 million years, it has doubled its radius. Jeez. Okay, hold on a minute. If that were true, then 70 million years ago, the force of gravity of the Earth was about a fourth what it is today. Yeah, exactly. Which is why those big dinosaurs could walk around then, but they couldn't possibly walk around today. Their bones would not support that weight today. Even though it's the same body, the same bones, and the same body mass, it's not the same gravity. It's four times what the gravity was at that point. So that means that there is a whole bunch of energy coming from someplace to form matter at the center of the Earth. You know, that point where it's zero. Sometimes it's a little more, sometimes it's a little less than zero. It can actually be negative gravity. In order for that to happen, it has to be connected to the universe, not just the Earth. And it has to be connected via a wormhole. So you get this little bitty tiny white hole at the very center of the Earth, and someplace out there there's a giant black hole sending new matter to it. Are you with me so far?
I'm with you. And I do have certificates in physics and know a bit about chemistry, so I understand the basis of what you're saying. In saying that, you've got people like Stephen Hawking that are changing their theories about black holes. What you're saying is not far out there. The thing that gets me too, but is when we look at gravity, you said it's four times more than what it was, so that means there's four times more the pressure pushing down on the Earth, but yet it is getting bigger at the same time. I'm wondering at the same time, if we look, I was talking about yesterday on the show about implants that are found, where what's weird about it is that the implants, the isotopic ratio of how they're constructed is done in a way of the elements where it could not be done on Earth. It's very similar to a meteorite. I'm wondering if there's stuff, because we don't know much about our own Earth within it, I'm wondering if we'd come across more elements that we haven't come across yet, going deeper, if there's new ones being constructed where, I think today we're synthesizing up to around 116, maybe something like that. I haven't checked for a little while. But this is where
for very short periods of time. Yeah, they tend to not stick around long.
Yeah, they're very, very microscopic.
They have a half-life in the microseconds.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're looking at this, but it makes me wonder about all this at the same time, because what you're saying is not losing me. It's actually opening up more questions, because just the way you're going about it is building a picture where, hey, we don't know so much, and there's a basis for what you're saying, and there are other, like when you put with what Albert Einstein has said and other physicists have said, how this is done, like this is possible, and they're going with evidence. There's something to it. So, yeah, you're not losing me. So what you're saying is that there's a type of white hole in the middle of the Earth, and it's connected to a black hole, basically feeding off it.
Right. The whole Einstein-Rosenberg bridge, which is where we get the whole black hole idea, cannot exist without a white hole at the other end of the bridge. Which means that our, you know, all the sci-fi fantasy traveling through a wormhole is not going to work. Not if you want to be alive at the other end, or in any recognizable form for that matter. A white hole is the antithesis of a black hole. A black hole, nothing can escape, not even light. A white hole, nothing can enter, not even light. Wow. I mean, that's just what it is. And the bridge is the two, and yet the bridge must exist for those two to exist, according to all the math. Now, have we seen any of that in action? No, we've never directly observed any of that. We can, however, possibly, just like the study of certain particles, study the secondary effects of the passing of those things. Like, we can't see a neutrino, mm-hmm. but we can get some kind of a photo detector in a cave down there where there is no light, and yet we'll get a flash of light on that photo detector because a neutrino passed through the rock and caused an electron to get jarred loose. And we say that's great science. Like, really? Because I'm not absolutely certain that's the only thing that could cause that photon to get knocked loose. But we still consider it good science. Could we possibly see secondary effects of a white hole or an Einstein-Rosenberg bridge or any of these things? Well, yeah, maybe. And maybe we already have and just didn't recognize what we were seeing. The Casimir effect. Are you aware of the Casimir effect?
No.
Okay, where the lab demonstration basically was two lead plates that were, you know, very thin from our point of view because, you know, we're macro, but they were thick to, say, an atom. You put them close together, they start forming their own gravitational field between them.
All right. Yep.
It also messes up the way light passes through the junction, or any energy passes through the junction.
So is there a type of distortion there?
Yes, there's some kind of a distortion that is not well understood, in fact, it's not understood at all, that apparently is gravitational in nature, you know, that weak force. But just putting two plates of lead or other elements close together seems to be enough to manifest this disturbance in the force, if you will. And we don't understand it, and we probably won't understand it until we do a lot more experimentation. But the Casimir effect may be one of those things where we've seen it, but we don't know what it is or how to explain it. We also have all of these absolutes in science, like, okay, light can't possibly go faster than 184,312 miles per second. Really? Because there was an experiment in Japan in 1996, I believe it was, where they got a pulse of light out of a mechanism before it entered.
Yeah.
And this was a juried paper. The mechanism was basically cadmium? I forget. It was a vapor of a metal. I don't think it was cadmium. One of the heavy metals was vaporized in a chamber with microwaves energizing it, exciting it. And they put a pulse of light into one end of it. But that pulse of light came out of it before it entered, according to all of the mechanisms they had hooked up to it to detect all this. So do we understand what's going on with that? Obviously not. Mm-hmm. What is it they use for the atomic clock, the element? That's what this chamber was in. This chamber.
All right. Yeah. And cesium. When you use the atomic cesium. Clock, when it's cesium, and when you can actually get to the higher parts of the atmosphere, the clock actually ticks at a different rate compared to when it's slower and closer
that's
to
correct.
The Earth. Yeah.
It does. And they say, well, that's Einsteinian relativity. Well, no, actually, it's not. It's Lorentzian relativity. And Tom Van Planen wrote a really good proof of that before he died. Tom Van Planen also wrote about, you know, planets can explode. That's why Mars is all scarred up. We could probably see it on Jupiter, too, but there's too much gas. But anyway, if you don't know about Tom Van Planen and the viewers as well, you can find his name all over the internet and some really good YouTubes.
So there's a lot that we don't know, even with gravity.
So there's all the science. With gravity.
Yeah.
We don't know anything.
I forget what they used to say gravity was, but now they're going more on the basis that gravity has a wave. It's a wave format. It's gravity waves, where beforehand, back in the 80s, right. They didn't say it. Then you had scientists saying, well, we think it works more like a gravity wave. Even in Australia now, it's known that we're teleporting, and around the world they're doing it now, they're teleporting particles a few miles and kilometres, a photon. They're teleporting in an instant. So for people where this is far out, we're actually doing stuff that almost is in Star Trek. Well, that is in Star Trek. The only problem is we can't do it to physical matter or, you know, we don't know how this is done. We can do it on a particle level of a photon. So
the best we can do is send information really fast.
Yeah, that's it at the moment. So when we look at all this is what's in the public domain. This is what we're working with, and still we're learning more. Again, it brings up more questions than answers you get as we go down.
Yes, it does. But since you brought up gravity and its nature, what is the speed of gravity?
Nobody knows, do they?
No. Everybody says, well, it can't be faster than light. It's like, really? Why not? We obviously don't know the speed limit of light either, apparently. But again, Tom Van Planen wrote a really good paper, a treatment, and his conclusion, which I can't tear apart, and I've never found a mathematician who can tear it apart. The speed of gravity has to be at least 20,000 times that of light. Oh, did I mention he was the former chief astronomer at the U.S. Naval Observatory? It's not like he's pulling this out of the air.
Yeah. Did he feel this was worked in a wave format as well? That it was gravity was a wave?
He didn't even address that part of it. Right. He wasn't truly an astrophysicist. Mm-hmm. He was an astronomer, and his observations were based on, well, you got these gravitational lenses. And yeah, it not only bends light, it changes the way light works. So he had a whole big problem with the whole redshift / big bang thing as well. And I agree with it. It's a theory that uses most of what we know to support itself, not to study the data. It supports itself.
With gravity, what do you think its relationship is to the electromagnetic field? Because There seems to be some sort of connection in terms of the Earth has the same electromagnetic field, but yet there's gravity working in cohesion. In some format, there's got to be some connection. You talked about the bending of light. We hear this on about some types of UFOs and that type of thing, where there is, with gravity, it can shape, it can warp, it can distort. There's a difference in time if you know how to manipulate gravity, we theorize. So what do you think, is there a relationship between the electromagnetic field and gravity?
Oh, there's certainly a relationship. Is it a direct link? I'm not certain. However, I would say this, with the apparent vast difference in the velocities of light versus gravity, then light is going someplace gravity has already been. in all cases. What does that mean to the red shift? Well, over vast distances, it may mean that the red shift has absolutely nothing to do with an expanding universe. The whole tired light thing starts to come back and say, oh, remember me? Because I may actually be accurate. But nobody wants to consider that. You know, you've got these, I call them TV guys, Tyson and Bill Nye and all these guys who go out there and say, well, this is what we think. They never say, we want to look at the alternatives. No. They say, this is what we think. I'll give Tyson credit. He calls it just a theory. It's the Big Bang theory. Mm-hmm. Although it's taught as fact when you go to school. I don't care what school you're going to. So there are some disconnects between what is real in science and scientific method versus what is taught in school. Until you get up to that, you know, postgraduate, you don't get to ask these questions. You just get to regurgitate what you're taught.
Yeah. It's exactly how it works. With going into this now, into the Hollow Earth a bit more, going by your theory and your research, what would be under there? Would there be obviously types of cavern? If it goes by the format that you're talking about, how it's evolved and grown, there would obviously be some type of caverns, systems, something set up underneath there. And if there is things at the depths of our ocean going kilometers down that can survive without any light, that defies science in terms of needing light or whatever to live, and we could talk about microbacteria, right, any types of life, what information and what theories have you got about inside
what
the
could
Earth?
Be inside the Earth? Well, we already know that there are what I call deep microbes, 50 miles or so. We only know that because of what's been belched up out of the Earth that has tracks of microbes in it.
All right, yeah.
And at 50 miles, they have to be pretty tolerant to high temperatures, as well as all kinds of really weird gases. Let me take care of this cat for a moment.
You're right.
Speaking of weird microbes.
What type of cat is it?
So, a Manx cat.
All right.
A very vocal Manx cat.
We've got a couple here. We've got the
microbes and the various. I'm sorry?
We've got a couple of cats here. One of them is a ragdoll. It's huge.
Well, he can be, or he can be a Tasmanian devil. Depends on what kind of treats he's getting or not getting. And forms of life. We got all these forms of life on the surface. We have no idea what's under the surface or even in the bottoms of the oceans. We're starting to collect data on things that come to the surface of the ocean, grab other things to eat, and take them to the depths in a matter of a couple of minutes. And whatever's taken to the depths is also warm-blooded, according to the telemetry. We have no idea what that could be. What could be under the surface of the Earth, the hard rock? Well, we really don't know, but we know that there's an absence of light. And yet we also know that there are microbes that can survive in there. There are microbes that can eat oil. There are microbes that can eat rock. There are microbes that can eat, you know, alcohol. We don't know much. We like to think we know a lot, but we really don't know much. And until we get down there and actually look, or at least retrieve some samples some way, by the way, it's easier to retrieve moon rock than it is rock from 50 miles down. A lot easier. So yeah. We have to devise experiments. I'm sorry?
It makes you think about that and just the research and the money going into things like that where – you think as a collective or just for research purposes, you'd want to get down into the Earth and see what we've got right at our own in our own backyard beneath our feet.
Right. Well, in Australia, you have a couple of regions where apparently gold just boiled up out of the Earth. And you can go along on top of the ground and pick it up. Okay, not as much as you could 50, 100 years ago, but the metal detectors are still having a ball with it. In the Lake Superior region of North America. Same thing happened with copper. There are pure chunks of copper tens of miles long, 6 or 8 inches thick, and 10 or 12 feet wide. Just pure copper. And I'm talking 99.9% fine copper.
That's fine, yeah.
We don't understand the mechanisms that cause this. But that's part of what led me to this idea that there's this white hole. And as the gravitational wave changes its nature, it changes what is formed, what matter is formed out of this white hole. We don't know enough to really figure out why the rocks come out of the earth, the lava comes out of the earth the way it does. And when you get into pure elements, we have no idea how that happened. If we do it on the surface with our technologies, we can only do it with electrolysis to get that high a grade. Don't know what's happening inside the earth to give us pure gold, pure copper, pure iron, pure whatever. Now, we've got all kinds of ores that are dirty and take a lot of processing to get up to something even usable. But when it comes out of the ground already pure, we have no idea.
So
we are just happy to find, especially the gold.
And you're exactly right. We it's very hard to get anything pure, if pure at all. There's always something connected with it. There's always something that's a part of it. With your theory and with what you're talking about, with the white hole inside the Earth, if we look at other planets, for example, would this mean that there is some type of symbiotic relationship between planets with their own white holes and black holes? Is there anything that we could, or is that grasping at straws there?
I don't know that it's grasping at straws. We don't know enough to, we're speculating at this point because I haven't been there either. I don't know what's going on inside the Earth. This is the only explanation I can come up with for the phenomenon that we observe. And from my understanding and perspective, that's what science is. Inspect the phenomenon, try to offer an explanation. Whereas the Kola borehole, it's like, oh, that's cool. Ignore it. We're going to go along with what we already thought. We do that with so many things, it's upsetting. And Professor Feynman, whose name escaped me a while ago, the guy who said, when these two waves cross, it splits off into a proton and an antiproton. And they will, almost all of them will collapse back into the energy field and remain energy. But once in a while, the antiproton will be drawn away and the proton lives on to make new matter. Well, that's great, but what happens to that antiproton?
And the buck stops there. Nobody wants to go any further. Yeah, nobody wants to go any further with it. And there's a hell of a lot you can do with that. The energy that you can get from that is, quite extensive. And this is the thing now. Like, we're looking at, you know, the moon. We know there's helium-3. We know that if there was a strong enough reactor we could put it in, we would get from a teaspoon enough energy to run the Earth for a day. But we can't do that because there's no way we can contain that, all the energy. But what about if we've got stuff in our own backyard?
We retrieve it at this point.
Yeah, we retrieve it. But,
but since you said something about the energy used in a day, there's also energy produced by the Earth. The Earth produces about 4 terawatts of infrared energy. Now, this is considerably more than it receives from the sun. This is in addition to what it received from the sun. And the explanation, oh, well, that's left over from the planet formation 4.5 billion years ago. It's the friction, blah, blah, blah. Like, really? Because we're in cold space, dude. And if it were going to emit that much energy for that long, it had to have been hotter than the sun at the beginning. And it was not, or we wouldn't be here at all. Therefore, there is some energy release, some energy production mechanism within the Earth itself. And, you know, 1,200 miles of Earth to go through before it's emitted into space. How hot is it at the center if that's happening? Well, 4 terawatts is a lot of energy. It's about 1/3 of what we use in electrical power per day on the entire planet. Well, hey, maybe if we could harness even that 4 terawatt, we could go ahead and live on this planet another 100 years before we completely use it up.
Maybe it's some type of waste. Obviously, if there's this energy, it has to come from somewhere, and it's what comes to mind is something almost like a natural thermionic generator where we've got heat, and from the heat there's a release of energy. And if we could harness that energy, we could use that like you're saying. So this is something that's going on in our own backyard right now, and scientists are saying, oh, it's left over from this, but it can't be left over. So that's a very good point you're making.
That math doesn't add up at all. Mm. Yeah, it's new energy from somewhere else. It has to be. And if there is some mechanism where that energy is arriving from somewhere else, say the center of the galaxy in our hypothetical huge black hole, supermassive black hole, through that Einstein-Rosen bridge to a tiny little white hole that makes up this minuscule little planet that we live on, maybe we should be trying to use that instead of using up all the other resources, or maybe in addition, because pretty soon the entire planet is going to be elbow to elbow in people if we don't do something.
Now,
and we're energy hogs. We're all energy hogs.
Well, that's something on your side.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, a vehicle just went by.
That's all right. Sound like a UFO buzzing down or something. Anyway.
Yeah, I live at the edge of Amish country. You never know what's going to go by.
Out in the sticks, are you?
I am. I'm 4 miles from each of two different municipalities, if you want to call them that. Mm-hmm. Each of the towns has about 700 people in it.
Good population.
And no stores in either one. So
yeah, what you have to do about a 40-minute drive to try and get food somewhere if you've got to go to the groceries?
Yes. 40 minutes, more than 40 minutes round trip to go buy a loaf of bread, yes.
That's out in the sticks. Yeah, I would actually like that. I mean, I've moved to the city now. Now getting back to the Hollow Earth, when we hear these stories about I forget the dude's name, but I think it was going back to the early 1900s where some dude apparently flew into a hole in the South Pole, or we hear stories about the North Pole. I'm fascinated about where you've gone with you're using science, using your own research. Basically, there's nothing that's been able to back that up through the research and the people you've spoken to about that type of Hollow Earth where people have flown in. I think they've said they've seen a city and a sun or something like that. You're right. Going purely by science, but has there been anyone you've spoken to that sort of made you think otherwise about that, or it just there's nothing to confirm?
As far as a big hollow spindle type space within the Earth, it's poles, no. Part of my research, however, has been what would happen to the crust if that were true. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to the deep ocean mapping, meaning what are the rift patterns? What is the topography of the ocean bottom? And there's some really interesting topography on the ocean bottom. It's all crisscrossed with faults of all kinds in all directions, although they keep a pretty general pattern along the rifts. There's a mid-ocean rift in the Atlantic. There are three major ones in the Pacific. And they say, well, that's the big Pacific Rim where the ocean is simply turning on the globe. It's like, really? Because, sorry, that just doesn't quite work. But there are rifts, and the ocean bottom is drawing apart. Marianas Trench is one of those. Not very far from you, comparatively speaking. It's a lot further from me. But it's also the deepest point on the planet. There's another pretty deep point in the Arctic Ocean, you know, where Admiral Richard E. Byrd supposedly flew his plane into the Earth and back. And according to his own log, he never made it to the pole, but he got pretty close. In that ocean, in the Arctic Ocean, the deepest point, according to most of the maps, is 13,200 feet. And it's a hole in the ocean. It's an abyss, a true column of water shoving down through the bottom of the ocean. Leading to it, however, are all of these riverbeds on the ocean bottom. Like at one point, there was no water other than these rivers flowing through this hole in the bottom of the ocean. And it's west, southwest of the actual geographical pole by, I don't know, a couple hundred miles. It's 84 and a half north and 2-3 west, I believe it is. But you can actually see it on the ocean bottom maps. There's also a ridge, a mid-ocean ridge, very distinct, that cuts all the way across the Arctic Ocean. And it's also very completely consistent with Neil Adams' theory, incidentally. If you take that, now we're going to jump to the Mahabharata. I can never say that word right. The Indian epic, where the guru
was on a white mountain. Oh, is that the
Mahabharata? Thank you. Where the guru lived on a white mountaintop at the top of the world. And there was ocean on each side of him. Well, that ridge right now is only about 700 feet below sea level. At some point during the last ice age, it was above sea level. And he may have actually lived there, but we would have to go down, you know, several hundred feet and do a detailed study on that one seamount to see if there was a residence there. And oh, by the way, he was a guru. The only thing he had for furniture was a few rocks. So we have to be very, very careful how we study things like this. Mm. But we can't rule out all these things as, oh, well, that's just, you know, that's just folklore. That can't be real. Well, how do you know until you look? Then to go look, you have to have funding too. So.
Well, you do. And this is where a lot of people say, why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing that? And it's like, well, where's the money to do so? A lot of, like this, the show that I do, a lot of what I do is funded off my own back. As you would know yourself, it doesn't matter how good you are with your books. There's not a lot of money in books either. I know a couple of bestsellers, world bestsellers, and they're lucky to get $500 every 6 months for their sales. So this is where we're networking. When we've got opportunities to go and see something in person or to go and talk to somebody, you know, we're doing the best that we can with what we've got. Yep. And if we did have the funding,
The best opportunity to actually fund some of these things is this, the whole crowdfunding phenomenon, where people say, I like that idea. I'm going to throw money at that.
Yeah.
And then you get these scoundrels who will occasionally say, thank you, I'm done now. Mm. Thank you for your money, but, oh, well, I can't really do this research or whatever it is. And that ruins it for everybody, or tends to. But you also have this whole foundation / rich people, I'm talking truly filthy rich people, who can throw money at things and not miss the money, no matter what the results of the endeavor is. Well, you know, we've lost a few. Steve Jobs used to do a little bit of that.
Mm.
But, well, he's gone now. So let's see, who else could we go for? Oh, yeah, Bill. Bill Gates. Bill Gates has all the money in the world. He could throw a lot of money at this. No. He's looking for healthier mosquitoes. let's see. We'll find somebody, though. One day we'll find somebody who wants to fund this kind of research. And there is the potential payoff of 4 terawatts of free energy.
Well that's the thing. Wasn't Tesla looking into stuff like that?
He certainly was, and by some accounts, he was completely successful.
And he was looking at how to transfer it also, wasn't he? Not just to derive it from the Earth, but also how to transfer it wirelessly to other places where they could basically tap into it and use it for themselves.
Right. You've seen a lot of, I would call them, fantastic representations of how he did that. Mm. You know, just screwing a light bulb into the dirt, and it would light up. Well, sorry, that's not quite going to work. He did, however, demonstrate the best, at that time, knowledge of the whole radio wave universe of anyone, well, in some ways, still. There are still nobody who can duplicate some of his efforts. In 1908, I believe it was 1908, he was still working with Radio Phenomenon, even though Marconi got the patent. Tesla was still working with it, and he got a signal. No, it was 1901. He got a signal. Somebody else was working with radio waves when he invented it. So what was up with that?
Yeah.
And then in 1908, he was working with beam energy, and Tunguska blew up 200,000 square miles. You know, like, oh, okay, it's an impact. Really? Where is the meteoritic material of that exploded comet / asteroid / whatever it was? There isn't any. But there was a huge explosion over Siberia. On a day that Tesla was running an experiment.
That's interesting, that in itself. That in itself is very interesting. I think we could learn a lot for Tesla, and it seems more and more people are actually looking at him now. I just don't know why he hasn't been looked at in schools, why he hasn't been studied. We hear about Einstein and Edison, but we don't hear much, if anything, at all about Tesla, and it's like nobody wants to go there.
Well, certainly Westinghouse doesn't want to admit that they screwed him over three different times.
Yeah.
Well, and every other company that makes or sells anything electrical, because his patents would have run out towards the end of this past century if he'd never put in any improvement patents, you know, and regenerated that. He held patents on electric motors, alternators, transformers. Pretty much everything that we use today for alternating current is Nikola Tesla's baby. The hydroelectric plant at Niagara Falls, he drew that out by hand. And Westinghouse said, thank you. Oh, wait, here's a nickel. Of course, Tesla also blew up a couple of power plants with his experiments, which is why he moved out of Colorado, incidentally. Because they were ready to go after him with, you know, hayforks and flames and
whatnot. Off him off.
But, yeah, well, the angry mob syndrome. But he actually went down the mountain and rebuilt that whole power plant off his own nickel.
Jeez.
So that, yeah.
That's hardcore within itself.
And then the whole New York. Yeah, it's a great story. Nikola Tesla was an amazing person, and he had contemporaries who were also amazing people. Contemporaries, yes. Perhaps even acquaintances. You ever heard of Ed Leedskalin?
No.
Ever heard of the Coral Castle in Homestead, Florida?
No, I haven't heard of that either, no.
Okay, this guy built this castle, so to speak, about, I think it covers close to an acre, out of huge blocks of limestone coral. Some of them weighed 25 tons. He did all this by himself.
Jeez.
Did it all by himself. And he was, again, a contemporary and perhaps an acquaintance. And the only tools that you could find on his entire place were stuff he'd fashioned out of junk Model Ts.
And there's 25 ton rocks of limestone.
Yes.
Bloody hell.
And he moved them. He raised them out of bed because, you know, pretty much all of South Florida is this material. He cut them and raised them out of the bed and shaped them and stood them up and connected them together, some of them. And he built a mentor that's, I should say, an obelisk that's about, I think it's about 40 feet tall. I'd have to go back and look at my figures, my notes again, and it's aligned perfectly to the North Star. And he knew when he set it up, it would be perfectly aligned, because he had bored a hole in it, put a crosshair in it, and then stood it up.
What do you think the purpose behind that is? Is there any, did he ever say what the purpose behind lining up with the North Star was?
No, I think he just did it because he enjoyed doing it. You know, he charged somebody a dime to come look at his castle.
Yeah.
A 10-cent piece, which, you know, in the 1920s, 30s, which, you know, it's, and today that same dime's worth, oh, I don't know, $5 or so as silver, not as coinage.
Can you go and visit that site today?
Yes.
Yeah.
You can. One aspect of it has ceased functioning. He had a gate, I believe it was a 10-ton, give or take, block of limestone on an axle, and it was vertical axle, so it actually spun. It was like a rotating door, spinning door. And there was an earthquake, a rare Florida earthquake, and it knocked that off balance, and it doesn't work like it did. You used to be able to just push on it with one finger and move that 10-ton block of stone.
That's amazing.
And it was suspended. It was suspended on a Model T axle. Ford engineer said it couldn't possibly hold up that much, and yet it did.
Yeah. Now they're good old strong cars, the old Ford T models.
Yep. And a lot of them in their day.
Yeah. Now the way to go back then. You know, and it's still a couple around every now and then. You find them even here in Australia, a couple every now and then done up nice. Not a bad car.
They're hard to beat up. They actually pass the low speed collision test better than any new car today.
They don't build them like they used to.
At 5 miles an hour, they just bounce off of each other.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. That's trippy. Now, look, we'll wrap it up in a minute. What's going on with yourself at the moment in terms of in what you're investigating or researching? Can you give us a heads up on anything that's going on at the moment?
Yeah, I'm working on an article for the next Ancient American magazine, which I believe will be published first week in March, which means I have to finish it up by the end of this month. And it is about a plant that shouldn't be where it is. Now, my most recent article was also about a couple of plants that should not show up where they do, but they are there. This next one is about a plant that shows up on Isle Royal in the middle of Lake Superior, and it shouldn't be within 1,000 miles of that place, and yet it is. And it is the nature of that plant and that place that makes this an interesting story, because that's also where all of that pure copper showed up.
All right, yeah.
Now, who was mining that copper 7,000 years ago that needed that plant to get them by?
Now, that's very interesting. That's very interesting.
That plant is called Devil's Club, and it is, the Pacific Coast natives use it for 36 different conditions as a medicinal plant, including cancer. And recent research, laboratory research, says, that just might be true. But that's not the most important aspect of this plant for that place. And I'm saving that for the article.
Yep. No,
so you'll have to read it.
Yeah. No, we'll do. And there's links up to your websites where the books are available and that, and where people can get more info. So just look at the bottom of the video or where you've downloaded this audio show. Just go there for links. But Rick,
yep.
It's a pleasure having you on and talking to you again. I've learned a lot. I hope the audience, it's opened up their mind and let them look at things a little differently than what they have. And
yeah, definitely go look for yourselves. Don't take me as an authority. Take me as a person who asks questions.
Yep.
So,
all good. Well, thanks, mate. And we'll chat again soon. And again, thank you for being on.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Cheers, mate. Bye-bye.